This is NHPR News.
This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, stories of immigrant teens at a Brooklyn high school put human faces to the nation's immigrant debate. And real-world political theater becomes a plotline for fictional TV shows. Plus, when school's out at St. Paul's, a band of faculty assembles to study at the prep school of rock and roll. But we begin today with the other South American drug war. Last year, a Wellesley College professor exposed details of public health workers deliberately infecting Guatemalan prisoners with syphilis in the 1940s. President Obama apologized, and American government officials assured the public that regulatory oversight would prevent any such ethical lapses today. Investigative journalist Kelly Hearn reports in The Nation about regulatory and bureaucratic loopholes and corruption that allowed the pharmaceutical industry to outsource drug trials to contractors today. It's a $20 billion industry growing quickly, especially in South and Central America. Kelly Hearn, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So the Guatemalan prison case, of course, the Tuskegee experiments, there is a history of ethical breaches in medical research. So what kind of regulations have been put in place to prevent that in human testing?
Well, there have been many regulations, and I guess the institutions which have stepped forward to sort of mitigate those sorts of problems or to keep them from happening are institutional review boards or ethical review committees. And these are basically voluntary committees of varying types of experts that have the power to oversee clinical trials and to make sure that they're protecting the rights and welfare of human research subjects. So when we talk about Guatemala, that is a case of overt criminality. And I think most of the people that I talk to would agree that the world really doesn't have to worry about that level of thing happening again. Mostly there are concerns that medical expediency is winning out over human rights. And when I say human rights, I mean more things like informed consent in clinical trials. What we're seeing now is that 10 years ago or so, most clinical trials that took place in American academic institutions.
Uh-huh.
But now it's a global game, and it's dominated by corporations called contract research organizations. And as you noted, it's a $20 billion industry. The problem is that the FDA is swamped. They're hit by budget cuts. They're unable to review this data, to verify the quality of the data, and to ensure that the rights of subjects are protected. And very quickly, I want to say that in 2010, there was a report by the Inspector General of the Department of Health and Human Services that noted that in 2008, 40 to 65% of clinical trials on FDA-related products took place overseas. But of nearly 6,500 foreign trial sites that year, the FDA inspected only 45.
Wow.
And that's less than 1%.
Less than 1%. Now, we've heard of these change, you know, of making some reform anyway in places like India and Africa. I'm thinking of the thriller The Constant Gardener a few years ago depicted drug trials going on to the unwitting public in Africa. Now it's in South America. Now, you spoke with a Peruvian doctor who described a system of what he called medical colonialism in his country. So what is it that makes the conditions there open to this exploitation?
Well, a few of them are logistical. Latin America it is a closer time zone. More people speak Spanish than they would speak languages, say, Eastern languages. Another issue is that Latin America, the population of Latin America, which I think is around 600 million, most live in cities. And because there are poor healthcare systems, people tend to congregate in large public institutions. So if you are a contract research organization and you're looking to outsource your patient recruitment, if you need people, you need warm bodies that are willing to be in these trials because, frankly, they don't have any other options, you can go to just a few places. So in a way, it's like shooting fish in a barrel. You know, you have so many people to choose from. And so the people that I spoke with in Peru, Dr. Roberto Cuba, who is a Peruvian gynecologist who runs the Peruvian Medical Association, his comment about medical colonialism had a lot to do with the fact that a lot of the tests that are clinical trials that are carried out by investigators in Peru, and he put investigators in quotes because he said these aren't doctors doing real medical research. These are not people who are creating intellectual property, for example. These are people that are carrying out foreign clinical trials that are designed in the United States and run out of the United States.
Okay, so this is the question. Their U.S. drug company, does the FDA have jurisdiction over trials on their behalf, even if they take place someplace else?
The FDA has jurisdiction over any device or drug that enters the United States market. And let me tell you, one of the major crux of this whole issue, the regulatory loophole, has to do with something called an investigational new drug application, or IND. If you and I wanted to test a new drug or device, we have to go to the FDA, and this is in the United States, we have to go to the FDA, file an IND, and that puts us on the FDA's radar. That gives them time to look and see that the study is ethical and can go forward. If you are a federally funded researcher going out of the United States, you also have to get an IND, but you do not have to get an IND if you are a company, if you're a private company. So the fear is that these companies can go to, say, Africa or Bosnia or Bolivia without letting the FDA know in advance what's going on. They can test a drug or device, and if that test goes well, yippee, we take it back to the FDA.
And if it doesn't?
You close shop.
Mm. Give us an example of a study approved south of the border that would have never seen the light of day in the U.S. I was thinking of this Dominican, the HIV trial that you wrote about.
In the early 2000s, the Fogarty Institute, which is the U.S. government institute at the National Institute of Health, funded a U.S. researcher at the University of Miami, and she was trying to determine if massage therapy would boost the immune systems of HIV-positive children in the Dominican Republic. So these kids were dying of AIDS, but they were not taking antiretroviral drugs that were available in the United States at that time. The research, and keep in mind that not all clinical trials involve drugs or devices. So this is a clinical trial, even though this was massage therapy. So what happened was the researcher went to the Dominican Republic into a slum, paid 48 families $5 per clinic visit, twice a week for 12 weeks. The children were then randomized into two groups. One received therapeutic massage. The other, made of 12 HIV-positive children, again, met with a nurse for, quote, reading, talking, playing quiet games as part of a friendly visit control group. When that study was finished, according to a report in the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine, the researchers basically packed their bags and left without offering any of these dying children life-saving drugs.
Well, it looks like this story is far from over as U.S. Health and Human Services considers making new changes to research regulations. What are you looking at going forward? Is the problem going to get better or worse?
Well, it's difficult to say. I think the problem is certainly going to get more complicated. Right now, the regulations in the United States are so burdensome and so onerous, and many in the drug industry say that a lot of the hoops that they have to jump through really have no meaning. So you need some way to gauge whether or not all of these regulations and all of this paperwork, because basically it comes down to that, massive amounts of paperwork. So the question is, from an expediency point of view, do you set up regulations that streamline things and decrease confusion, or do you try to hold a tighter line, but maybe inadvertently creating, you know, more paperwork and more headaches and holding back medical advances? So quite frankly, the answer is, I don't know better or worse, but certainly more complicated.
Well, I know you're joining us from Argentina today. I really want to thank you so much for making the time, Kelly.
Sure, thank you. Have
Kelly Hearn, an investigative journalist, he reported on the rise of unregulated drug trials being outsourced by the pharmaceutical industry to South and to Central America. You'll find more, including a link to the article at wordofmouthradio.org. And when we come back, politics on TV. Nothing new, but it's on sitcoms and dramas now. That's when Word of Mouth returns in just a minute on NHPR.
I'm Randy Benthien of Benthien Associates. Frankly, one of the reasons that we have done this for 23 years and know we're going to continue supporting NHPR is that so many of the people that make decisions in our business and nonprofit clients also listen to New Hampshire Public Radio. And when they hear us sponsoring different programs, They remember us, and they think of us, and they contact us.
You're listening to Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. NPR's All Things Weekend host, Guy Raz, is going to be meeting up with Word of Mouth host Virginia Prescott. They'll be sitting down to talk about his experience as a foreign correspondent. And you're invited to come listen in and ask your own questions. For tickets and information, go to nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from UR members. And support also comes to us from Lang McLaury Spira, real estate affiliate of Lyon & Davis, specializing in fine New Hampshire and Vermont properties. LyonandDavis.com. New Hampshire weather this afternoon, mostly sunny. Today's highs 49 to 54 degrees. Tonight, partly cloudy and chilly. Lows tonight from 25 in the North Country, 25 to 30 in the Lakes region and Connecticut River Valley area, 30 to 35 degrees in southern parts of the state. Tomorrow we'll have a mix of clouds and sunshine with highs from 55 to 60. Friday will be mostly sunny and cooler, highs in the 40s. And Saturday, sunny, highs again in the 40s. Business and economic coverage on NHPR is made possible with support from Southern New Hampshire University School of Business. This is NHPR.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth. Primary season politics make for plenty of good mass market theater. Just listen to this clip of Texas Governor Rick Perry's so-called drunk speech being passed around now online.
This is such a cool state. I mean, come on, live free or die. I mean, you know, that's, you got to love that, right? I come from a state, you know, where they had this little place called the Alamo, and they declared victory or death. You know, we're kind of into those slogans, man. It's like, live free or die, victory or death. Bring it.
Since the Nixon-Kennedy debates, TV and politics have made a lively, if not always loving, couple. But the truth has often played better than fiction. Alyssa Rosenberg, culture blogger at Think Progress and a columnist for The Atlantic, looked at how TV sitcoms and dramas are reflecting the campaign mania and which ones are doing it well. Alyssa Rosenberg, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So all politics is retail. What are you, local rather, what are you seeing in the national scope? How are politics being played, the national campaign on TV shows today?
Well, we've had this explosion of television shows that are about politics and not just about the sort of national politics where people go on television and do a big national televised debate. They are about the sort of door-to-door, you know, city council vote counting, sort of grassroots politics in a way that's kind of entertaining. You've got Leslie Knope, the diehard Parks and Recreation assistant director on the show of the same name, who's running for city council in Pawnee, Indiana. You have Sue Sylvester and Kurt Hummel's dad squaring off for a state representative seat on Glee. You've got Claire Dunphy running for city council on Modern Family, and you have Kelsey Grammer making a return to television in a really striking, dramatic turn as Chicago Mayor Tom Kane on Boss, who is going head-to-head with his city council over things like trash collection. So television definitely has political fever this fall.
All right, let's start with a show that doesn't try for a nuanced approach. Here is a clip from Glee in which the Cheerio cheerleader Brittany is summing up her campaign for student council before launching into song, very Glee style.
And yeah, Kurt looks like Jimmy Fallon's butch daughter, but a vote for him would only empower yet another Frankenbeans.
Yes. Where has that patriarchy gotten us? Double-digit inflation, economic freefall, oil spills, war in Afghanistan.
I tweeted about Brit's flash mob pep rally in the gym, and we're all showing up to support her with girl power.
Yes. Boys have made one hell of a mess in this school, and there's only one way to clean it up.
So how many actual campaigns are using Beyonce to shore up their base these days, Alyssa?
You know, politics would be more fun if more of them would. You know, I mean, I think Glee has been sort of fascinating because it's had this overarching storyline this season where the evil cheerleading coach Sue Sylvester is running for state representative in a campaign that's supposed to be totally ridiculous. She's claiming that the arts are ruining students' lives and is pledging to cut arts funding. That would be hilarious and ridiculous if it hadn't actually happened in Kansas. Kansas governor, Sam Brownback, managed to defund and dismantle the Kansas State Arts Agency this year, which means that the state also has to forfeit all of its federal arts funding because it's contingent on a state match. So Sue may be over the top and ridiculous, but she's actually highlighting a fairly important issue that is going to cost people jobs and is going to cost communities arts programming in Kansas, sort of in an adjacent state. Brittany's campaign is sort of funny because I think it gets at a kind of shallow idea that all we need are women in politics, or, mm-hmm. you know, all we need is to sort of check off a quota. We need women. We need black people. Then everything will be different. And that's not really true, right? I mean, I don't think, you know, if Herman Cain or Michelle Bachmann is elected president, we're not suddenly going to have peace and flowers and fluffy bunnies. And there's, you know, but I think that strain of thinking that, you know, we need to sort of check a representative box is sort of unfortunately prevalent in politics and is a long way from, you know, a nuanced debate about the role that race and gender actually play in our political system.
Well, Glee's not known for nuance, I suppose. But here's
or
a clip.
Coherence either.
Well, you mentioned Boss. Now, this is Kelsey Grammer's new role. I haven't seen it yet, but your writing about it made me very interested. This is from the first episode. Now, he's Mayor Cain. Cain, funny choice for a name there, has just received a terrible diagnosis after taking only a few minutes to compose himself. Here he is speaking to a crowd.
Today, the First Presbyterian still holds daily services. It stands as a testament to an abiding truth about the nature of this great city. This most American of all cities. Chicago. Go ahead.
Mayor Chicago there, played by Kelsey Grammer. You know, it's interesting. It's so easy to sort of paint a satire in something like Glee. It's a little bit different or a different challenge to play politics seriously.
It is. And I mean, I think I talked to Mr. Grammer about the show and you know, one of the things that he said that I have mixed feelings about is that they were trying to tell a story that wasn't about politics, that was about power and what happens when people are threatened with the loss of power and what it means to accumulate power. And I think that that's a fair project. But I think it's important to acknowledge that parties do different things when they have power and they treat power in different ways. And, you know, TV can be a little scared of partisan politics sometimes. I mean, Leslie Knope on Parks and Recreation may be a committed Democrat, but we know that she also role plays as Margaret Thatcher with her boyfriend sometimes. So there's a little something thrown in there for the Republicans. And the show is all about sort of local issues. So, you know, abortion isn't going to come up. The closest thing that Parks and Rec has gotten to a hot button national issue is when Leslie accidentally marries two male penguins and, you know, unleashes the ire of Family Values Coalition.
Do you think, Alyssa, after the election, people's interest is going to wane in those political subdramas?
I mean, it's an interesting question. You know, I think that this is a hot election cycle. We've got a lot of colorful Republican primary candidates, and I do think that, you know, this is sort of hot right now. On the other hand, we live in a sort of never-ending campaign cycle. I mean, the presidential campaign at this point is 2 years long, which is half a presidential term. And even in years when we don't have presidential elections, we've got midterm elections, some of which can be big, exciting wave elections. So we live in a sort of constant political environment, and I'm actually surprised that shows don't have sort of a constant political undercurrent because of it. On the other hand, maybe everyone just gets burned out most of the time, needs something to escape from, and then politics sort of, you know, has a resurgence in a particularly colorful or eccentric election year.
Well, tell us about it. We're living in New Hampshire, and Alyssa, I want to thank you so much.
My hat to you. Thanks so much for having me on.
Alyssa Rosenberg, culture blogger at Think Progress and a columnist for The Atlantic. You can find a link to her article from Boston Glee. Do any of these season shows get politics right? That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. The U.S. and Russia have allegedly hit the reset button on their relationship, but there's still a leftover chill when it comes to American movie stars hawking Russian products, nearly edging out local talent. Jessica Gallagher, Word of Mouth's Eyes and Ears in Moscow, reports.
Do you really think you have a chance against our sophisticated cowboy?
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
does that sound like a man you trust your life savings with? A man who knows the ins and outs of banking?
I don't think you would see a campaign like that in the UK or in the US, particularly not in the banking sector, given recent economic history.
Adam Lewis is with the ad agency J. Walter Thompson in Moscow.
It's very much about communicating security, reliability, and this idea of thrill and risk is, to my mind, bizarre.
Well, apparently danger is the way to go with your money here, because diehard renegade Bruce Willis is the face of none other than Trust Bank. The bank's vice president, Dmitry Chuksiev, is quoted as saying that the company needed someone stable and understandable for the job. Stable and understandable?
He's an easy guy to like.
Come out to the coast, we'll get together, have a few laughs.
And a hard man to kill. Bruce Willis, Die Hard.
PR guru John Rose, owner of Rose Creative Services in Moscow.
In the West, we demand a little bit more of a connection between our spokespeople and the products that they represent.
And well, Rose says, Russians don't. Rose and others say Russians just identify with Bruce Willis's diehard personality and think, yeah, I believe that tough guy. Willis's slogans for the bank include, when I want money, I just take it. These foreign actors, known as migrant workers from Hollywood, are used constantly here. They include Cindy Crawford, Naomi Campbell.
The coffee, only from Brazil.
Coffee, только из Бразилии.
The suits.
And Sylvester Stallone hawking Russian ice vodka.
Характер от прабабушки. Стало быть, русский.
Алексей Андреев, president of branding agency Depot WPF, isn't laughing. Here he is on state radio. Andreev says it's shameful that Russian stars don't have the same pull as foreigners. That seems to be a growing sentiment here. But the fact remains that while Hollywood migrants hawk products all over the globe, in Russia, even the B-listers far outnumber local stars as spokespeople for major brands. Case in point, before Willis, Trust Bank used a famous Russian wrestler as their spokesman. But he didn't have nearly the same cachet or results as the diehard renegade. Trust claims that since Willis signed on, the bank has consistently ranked in the top 5 fastest-growing institutions for both credit card and deposit growth. Yippee-ki-yay, Hollywood. For Word of Mouth, I'm Jessica Gallagher in Moscow.
Coming up, a new book tells stories of students and teachers on the front lines of the American dream. A Brooklyn high school where every student is a recent immigrant. We'll hear about them when Word of Mouth returns. That's after the headlines from the BBC when Word of Mouth returns. On New Hampshire Public Radio, also online at wordofmouthradio.org, on Facebook and on Twitter.
Support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from you, our members, and from Southern New Hampshire University's online Master of Education program in curriculum and instruction with 5 high need concentrations and a certification track, snhu.edu. And Country Woods Furniture, Route 27 in Raymond, an independent furniture store dedicated to supporting local craftsmen and the local economy, online at cwuf.com. 1230, this is NHPR.
BBC News with David Austin. The French Prime Minister, François Fillon, has condemned the arson attack on the Paris offices of the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, which published a cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad on its front cover. The magazine also poked fun at Sharia. Lawyers of the WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, say they're considering an appeal against a decision by the High Court in London to extradite him from Britain to Sweden, where he faces questioning over sexual assault and rape charges. Mr. Assange said he hadn't been charged with any crime and called the allegations politically motivated. Britain, France and the European Union have condemned Israel's decision to speed up housing construction for Jewish settlers in the occupied West Bank. Israel announced the building program on Monday after the United Nations granted the Palestinians full membership of its cultural organization, UNESCO. The Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has insisted that the acceleration wasn't a punishment for that decision. The German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, has said she'll meet the Greek Prime Minister, George Papandreou, later for urgent talks on the Eurozone crisis. The meeting follows Mr. Papandreou's surprise announcement to hold a referendum on the latest Greek rescue package. A former Croatian interior minister, Josip Bulkovac, has been arrested over his alleged role in mass killings committed just after World War II. The 89-year-old is accused of ordering the murder of suspected fascist sympathisers on behalf of communist partisans. A survey by the anti-corruption group Transparency International has found that Chinese and Russian firms are the most likely to pay bribes when doing business abroad. And Bangladesh has signed a landmark multi-billion-dollar nuclear deal with Russia's state-owned nuclear energy company to build its first nuclear power plants. Bangladesh relies heavily on natural gas, but its reserves are running low and there are frequent power shortages. That's the BBC News.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Came in for school, graduated to the highlight. Ball players, rap stars, addicted to the limelight. Empty in May, got you feeling like a champion. The city never sleeps, better slip you an ambient.
For most teenagers, the track to high school is a straight progression from 8th to 9th grade. For others, may be acing a private school entrance exam. For students entering Brooklyn's International High School at Prospect Heights, incoming students must have lived in the U.S. for fewer than 4 years. And while they do have to take an English assessment test, it is failing that test that secures admission. Brooke Hauser is an investigative journalist who spent a year at the International High School. The remarkable stories she gathered there are the subject of her new book, The New Kids, Big Dreams and Brave Journeys at a High School for Immigrant Teens. It's a timely book with Republican candidates taking positions on public education for children of immigrants and passage of the DREAM Act in question. So, Brooke, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, first, a little background on INPS. Where do students come from?
Well, INPS, International's Network for Public Schools, is the network that oversees the International High School at Prospect Heights, which is the book, the school featured in the book. And kids come from more than 45 different countries and speak more than 28 different languages at the school that I reported at. It's kind of like having the entire world under one roof. They come from West Africa, Tibet, all over South America and Mexico, Nepal, everywhere you can think of, basically, there's a student representing that country.
So INPS itself, sorry, I mixed up the acronyms, is run by a nonprofit. It's not a public school.
INPS is the nonprofit, the International's Network for Public School, which oversees the International High School at Prospect Heights, which is a public school. There's a lot of names. It gets a little bit confusing, but the larger network oversees more than a dozen of these international high schools now. Most of them are in New York. A couple are opening in or have opened in California. And then the network is now talking to other places on the Southeast and in the Midwest about either opening or supporting similar international high schools.
Well, then let's get away from the acronyms and into
sure.
the stories. Well, you know, some of these kids, they wanted to be known. Others, as the principal says, will not be known. And Muhammad Ba is one of them. He is a son of a diamond miner from Sierra Leone who was still a child during that nation's very brutal war. Tell us a little bit about him.
Sure. Muhammad is one of the main students featured in the book. And he grew up in a very poor and rural village in Sierra Leone. He was raised in a mud brick hut with no electricity or running water. And basically, when he was around middle school age, he won a contest that was connected to a sponsored trip to Connecticut. It was hosted by basically a church in Connecticut. They had ties to Sierra Leone, and they wanted to bring over a student from that country. And they brought over Muhammad. And I don't want to give away what happens in the book, but let's just say he lived with this family in Connecticut and went to church, despite being a Muslim, for several weeks. And then if you read further in the book, you find out how he ended up in New York City. And he's one of the kids who is undocumented, and you know, he was one of more than 20 children that his father had with several different wives.
But he said he was the favorite.
And he said he was favorite. Yeah.
Well, there is. I mean, there's a lot of grandiosity in this kid in some way. He has very, very high hopes, but also extreme vulnerability. And I'm wondering how a teacher or a school begins to deal with the kind of varied pasts of these kids.
Well, you pointed out the key word, which is varied, and I think that the approach is varied, too, and that each kid really necessitates a different approach in some ways. I mean, there are several social workers who work at the school closely with the students who need the most attention, but every single kid at the school has an advisor, which is a teacher or other staff member who looks after the welfare of a group of students, not just their academic well-being, but their emotional well-being, because learning the language is a small fraction of what these kids have to learn upon getting to America. They're coming from, in many cases, rural villages, and they have to learn how to use the subway. They have to learn how to navigate a big, vibrant city like New York City.
Mm.
And then some of the kids are dealing with huge cultural pressures during the year, you know, not just SAT prep and stuff like that, but I knew several kids who had gotten married or were about to get married, who had had children deliberately, not as a mistake, but, you know, some of the girls from West Africa. This is a norm coming from some of those cultures, you know, to have a baby at 16 is not an unusual thing.
Mm.
So there were all sorts of challenges that came along with the students, depending on where they came from and when they got here.
You did spend a year there with them, hearing those stories, sometimes very intimate conversations. How did you build that level of access and trust at the school?
Well, I had written an article for the New York Times called This Strange Thing Called Prom, which was about the kids putting on their first ever prom, which was difficult for them because a lot of the kids had no idea what prom was, and they kind of studied what an American prom is the same way that I would have studied for a chemistry exam by renting movies like Mean Girls and saying, okay, this is what a prom king is, this is what a prom queen is, I get it. So that article was very well received by the school. It was just a fun piece. I loved reporting it. I loved the kids in the school. And I think that helped me earn the trust of the founding principal. As far as gaining the students' trust, I really just tried to be as transparent as possible. First of all, I had all of their parents sign release forms in, you know, I think 9 different languages. Students could sign themselves if they were of age. And I always had a reporter's notebook or a tape recorder. And to me, that was kind of like, you know, almost if you're a police wearing a badge or a uniform, it says, this is what I am. I am a reporter. You know, if you want to tell me your story, then come tell me. But it was important to me that I never felt like I was tricking anyone. And I felt that the students who would approach me and want to tell me their story would understand what it was going to be used for, a book. And so I think that transparency really helped.
Well, we learn all sorts of stories. There's Nuang, a Tibetan boy who spent the first leg of his journey to the U.S. over the mountains into India in a suitcase. Mm-hmm. We meet Yasmin, who is being pressured, as you alluded to earlier, to marry. It is a really varied and interesting account of stories based on these personal narratives in Brooklyn, this extremely diverse and integrated borough. So why is this story meaningful outside of Brooklyn, Brooke?
Well, you know, English language learners are all over the country, and New York is certainly a place that has had to grapple with these issues for a long time, but we've been seeing new immigrants and recently arrived refugees. They don't just go to New York City anymore. It's not just about Ellis Island. You know, it's small communities across the country are dealing with influxes of newcomers to the United States. You know, take a place like Vermont, you know, for instance. There are a lot of Somalis there.
And Manchester, New Hampshire, actually.
Manchester, New Hampshire, and Lewiston, Maine. So, you know, this is an issue that the whole country really has to think about, is how to educate our newest Americans.
Well, Brooke, we imagine that you will be hearing more from you, and thank you so much for sharing that with us today.
Thank you so much for your time. Take care.
Brooke Hauser, author of The New Kids, Big Dreams and Brave Journeys at a High School for Immigrant Teens. You can find links to some of the excellent reviews for the book, as well as more about the International High School at Prospect Heights. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, what do you think as international immigrants are changing the face of New Hampshire's high school population? Would a special school help them integrate successfully or just keep them more divided? Let us know at wordofmouthradio.org or on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. Coming up, Prep School of Rock, a band of academics holds tight to the rock and roll that still inspires them. We're going to turn it up to 11 when Word of Mouth returns after a short break. This is NHPR.
Two years after the death of Joan Didion's husband, just after she completed a memoir about grieving, Didion lost her daughter. Now Didion's written a memoir about her daughter's death. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Joan Didion, and we hear from British actor Bill Nye, co-star of the BBC movie Page 8 that airs Sunday on PBS. Join us. Fresh Air, today at 3 on NHPR.
It's Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. Thanks for spending some time with us on this Wednesday afternoon. Coming up on Here and Now, are there too many administrators in higher education? One professor says yes, and it comes at the expense of learning. Also, back rowing, egg corn, and fracking. New words for a new dictionary. That and more, it's Here and Now, coming up at 1 o'clock here on NHPR, where we get support from UR members. And support also comes to us from PSNH, working around the clock to restore power to those affected in all parts of the state. Information at psnhnews.com. PSNH, supporting your life in every moment. And from the Hanover Consumer Cooperative Society, the co-op food store is celebrating 75 years of local cooperation for the greater community good. New Hampshire weather this afternoon, mostly sunny with high temperatures 49 to 54 degrees. For tonight, partly cloudy and chilly. Lows tonight from around 25 in the North Country, 25 to 30 degrees in the Lakes region and Connecticut River Valley area, and from 30 to 35 in southern parts of the state. Tomorrow we'll have a mix of clouds and sunshine, highs 55 to 60. Friday, mostly sunny and cooler with high temperatures in the 40s. Saturday, sunny, highs again in the 40s. This is NHPR.
You're listening to Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. And a warning to our listeners, you're also hearing the sound of rock and roll descending upon our state. Introducing the Fletchtones, a band made up, well, of some kind of unexpected rockers. The Fletchtones is comprised of seven faculty members of the elite St. Paul's Prep School in Concord, and they've been playing together on and off and with various lineups for about 10 years. They jam on Tuesday nights and occasionally stage live concerts. The Fletchtones have a gig, a major gig, this weekend. They're going to be playing and giving a talk on Sunday as part of the Red River Theater's Rock and Roll Film Festival. It's an event tied to the Courier Museum's current exhibition of rock and roll iconography called Backstage Pass. And joining me in the studio now are two members of the Fletchtones. Terry Wardrop is guitarist for the group and also, incidentally, instructor of robotics and artificial intelligence at St. Paul's. That's Terry, thanks right. for being here.
Thank you.
And also joining us is Joe Holland, physics teacher and also the Fletchtones harmonica player and one of the band's vocalists. Joe, thanks for being here.
It's great to be here.
I can't believe you forgot your harmonica.
Next time.
Terry, tell us a little bit about the history of the group.
About 10 years ago, there were a group of faculty who we all realized we love rock and roll and started to get together, started to play. Shout out to North Conway. It was Jim Mahoney and the Mahoney brothers who used to play up there. They actually had a hit called Waiting for the Snow on North Conway Radio. So we would have to play it as our encore every time we played. Jim moved on to Minnesota. We have had a whole bunch of people join since then. And we just keep finding people who just love playing and love to talk about rock and roll.
Well, who's in your current lineup?
Well, we've got a whole bunch of J's. So we have Dr. John Bassey on drums. Uh-huh. Jer Williams is our bass player. We have Joe. And then we have Jada Ebra on vocals and Tina Abramson on vocals as well. And then the reason we're called the Fletchtones is we have Bill Fletcher, who's a choir director, New Hampshire composer of choral music.
Our musical guru.
He's our guru. He asked to join a few years ago when he finally went back to his high school roots, bought a Strat, came in, and he was very quiet. He sat in the background for a while and played along, and eventually he stopped and he said, would you mind if I made some suggestions? And he kind of took over, and we sounded okay, but after he actually told us what to do, we actually started to sound pretty good.
He schooled you.
Yeah, then we were a band. That's
then
right.
We
got schooled.
Yeah.
Well, how about musical selections? You only play covers?
We've dabbled a little bit.
Alongside from both of them.
We can play the blues and we can jam the blues. And Terry writes some songs and Jared's written a few songs. But yeah, we're mostly a cover band. We have a lot of fun with that.
Yeah.
And you're going to be playing and giving a talk at the Red River Theater. Now, what would you like to say to these audiences, the Rock and Roll Film Festival audience, about, you know, what are you going to say to them?
We were talking about that. We actually just really want to play rock and roll in front of people, so it's an excuse. But the idea was to talk a little bit about where the influences of rock and roll, where it all came from. So
we're going to take a musical journey. We're going to be on the
road.
The
decades.
It's going to be, yeah.
You're educators, after all.
That's true.
And
we,
you're all
we can't help ourselves.
I guess,
we will
in your
be,
own way.
We're going to try not to be didactic, but we do want to talk a little bit about the roots and where we think rock and roll is going.
Yeah. Well, speaking of roots, this is a woman who pulled a lot of them. This is Dusty Springfield's song,
yes.
Son of a Preacher Man, but we're going to hear the Fletchtones performing it.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son. When his daddy would visit, he'd come along. When they got around and started talking, that's when Billy would take me walking. To the backyard we'd go walking. Then he'd look into my eyes.
Well, Tina Abramson on vocals there, taking
That's
it to the bridge, Jade I might
on
say.
Lead. That's Jade on lead, but Tina's in the background there, yeah.
There is some academia in your talk. As you said, you may be not be able to refrain, but how about that sort of like transition from rock and roll, the early rock and roll we think of and see in some of those images at the Courier Gallery, I don't know if you've been yet, but to more sort of contemporary, more modern music.
Yeah. Well, we've watched it change, and I mean, we love talking about it. And actually, there's a lot of fun you can poke at it, which is the sort of the Spinal Tap kind of idea. We've watched how people get very self-important about it, but it really is. We like to be a garage rock band, which is there's not a lot of fancy stuff. It's just make it loud.
No really effects, no dry ice.
Well, okay. if we want to be Spinal Tap-ish, I mean, we would like to try that kind of stuff.
A lot of our rehearsals kind of border on spoofing ourselves.
Yeah.
We're definitely just joking around with ourselves, and our drummer especially will do something really self-important and pompous, and our bassist will just cut them right. Yeah,
it's amazing
his case
how
and cut
many
down.
Times we end
we do
up
that back and forth a few times.
Black Sabbath songs.
Yeah,
just I don't know where they come from, but that's where we end up.
Yeah, we'll be trying to figure out some vocal harmony or something like that, and the three vocalists will be getting together and you know really noodling, and then the rhythm guys in the background. Yeah, we'll just pull out some Blue Oyster Cult or something.
That was Joe Holland. Also, Terry Wardrop is with us. There are two members of the Fletchtones, a band that's been playing together on air for 10 years and made up of 7 faculty and staff members of St. Paul's School, most of whom are not in the music department, I might add. But, you know, you're talking about the spirit of rock and roll and, you know, why people get into rock and roll when you're a kid, you know, seeing guitar players. It's so compelling. But, I mean, what do you want to do with this band? Do you think maybe we'll get a break together? You know, is there a dream that you're keeping alive on some level?
We're definitely keeping a dream alive. I've always been a dreamer.
How
think
about
that's
a fantasy?
All of us. Yes, exactly. We're living out our rock and roll fantasies in the basement of Memorial Hall every Tuesday night. I don't think it's going to go too much farther than that, but it sure is great
fun
to be on NHPR.
Yeah. Just to watch the kids. So there is this rock band room in the basement where the kids can actually go and just be really loud and play rock and roll, and we get to do it too.
Okay, so I was looking at this exhibit at the Courier. You know, you see these rock and roll poses. And in a way, besides hearing the sound, there is a kind of image of rock and roll, right? You know, there is the kind of look, you know, from Elvis to Sid Vicious, you know, at varying different stages. I mean, do you guys get caught up in that at all? I mean, what do you wear to gigs?
About this, now, we did a B-52s, and some B-52 wigs definitely came out. So, yes, people do work a little bit about it. We're aware of it, and we enjoy it when it's time to do it. But generally, we
don't. We try to shop locally for our sequin vests and our tight pants and that kind of stuff. But so it's a couple times a year we'll dress up. But mostly it's just whatever, you know.
Well, we were listening to some of your tracks yesterday. Very good, really. And you know, I'm a big fan of the cowbell in rock music, you know, and I'm always trying to find the cowbell.
We were going to name the band More Cowbell at one point.
No kidding.
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay, so we're on the same track. And we all had this discussion in our little pod about great cowbell songs. So there's a particular fever.
We can already tell you what you're going to play.
Okay, well, how about this? How about this instead? How about if we do a little quiz here? Mm. We found several lists of the top rock and roll songs featuring the cowbell. Mm-hmm. So I want you guys to try and identify a couple of them. We're going to give you a softball first.
Stones.
Okay, which song?
Honky Tonk Woman.
Okay, all right. I just...
Yeah, thanks for the softball to warm up. That's true. Go ahead, give us a hard one.
All right. Well, I don't know how hard this is, but you know how many songs are there after all? Here's another one.
Oh,
that's a dead giveaway.
Classic.
Oh. Yeah. So Don't Fear the Reaper. Not a good song to play for high school kids.
I guess you have to think about that kind of thing. Yeah. Okay, kind of all right. We'll try another one. Might be... Ready?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to, you know, maybe I'll have to do my own.
Yeah. I should have brought a cowbell with my harmonica.
There we go.
Mm.
So we play this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You play?
Lowrider.
Lowrider.
By War. It's
by War.
Just a great tune.
Okay.
All right. Good to dance to.
Well, we incidentally happen to have the Fletch Tones version of that song that
Bill
we're going
Fletcher
to be listening to.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
Bill
he plays a
playing
mean
the cowbell.
Yep.
I wonder, just before people hear it, I want to know who's doing the voice, because you do the full-on, low.
Yeah, that's me.
Yeah.
I can get up here, and I can go down there.
Yeah.
Well, these are the people who are educating some very fine young men and women these days. Yeah. Joe Holland, Fletch Tones harmonica player. Now vocalist also that we're listening to, and a physics teacher at St. Paul's. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
And Terry Wardrop, instructor of artificial intelligence and robotics at St. Paul's, and guitarist for the Fletch Tones. Thank you so much for joining us too.
Thank you. We'll see everybody on the 13th.
I just want everyone to know they're both wearing sequins right now, all locally bought. Thanks so much for joining us to our Word of Mouth. Today we have details on the Fletch Tones appearance at the Red River Theater and also the Rock and Roll Movie Film Festival and the Backstage Pass Show, as well as a special event this week. Our own Rebecca Lavoie will be interviewing Tim Riley. He's the author of the new book on John Lennon that's been getting terrific reviews. All that information online at wordofmouthradio.org. Please join us again tomorrow for Word of Mouth at noon and again at 9 p.m. here on NHPR.
It's Marketplace Tech Report from APM, American Public Media. I'm John Moe. Mark Cantor of Cleveland, Ohio, has a 7-year-old and a 9-year-old at home. Each has a Facebook account.
Because they really wanted to be on Facebook. And my experience as a parent is when you tell some kid they can't do it, that just makes them want it more.
So Mark set up accounts for his kids, violating Facebook's terms of service to do it. Facebook bans kids under 13.
The key sign-up stage where they're asked for their age, yes, absolutely, we lied, and we're telling them the reason why they're saying you can't be on there is because of, and then we had to politely explain to them what a predator was, what were these negative things that could happen, and why they don't want to respond to people they don't know.
Mark's situation isn't unique. New research indicates underage kids are flocking to Facebook. More than half of 12-year-olds in a recent study lied and got accounts, usually with mom or dad's help. Dana Boyd is with Microsoft Research. She co-authored the study.
For a lot of parents, social media is a part of everyday life, and they want their children to have access to these services. Sometimes they want access in order for their kids to communicate with grandma or with them. Sometimes they want it because they think it's really important that they help their kids learn how to navigate these spaces. All of these are perfectly legitimate reasons, and they want to actually have final say over what their children may and may not access online.
The rule about being 13 is there because of the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, or COPPA, which was passed in 1998.
The idea was that any commercial website that collected data about children under the age of 13 would need to actually get parent permission. And it was an extremely well-intended piece of legislation. The challenge is that in implementation, it was extremely difficult for companies to comply. There were technical issues, there were questions of free speech, there were economic issues, that it was expensive to comply. And so what a lot of these companies decided to do is that rather than deal with the complexities of complying with COPPA, they just decided that they would restrict access to children 13 or older.
But kids still want to get to these sites, and parents want them to get there too, so everyone lies. Boyd says that's not the only way COPPA has been ineffective.
The questions about privacy have only gotten more complicated, the result of which is that while most of the goals, you know, a decade ago were to focus on vulnerable populations in the form of children, in many ways, everybody's vulnerable and confused about what's happening with their data online. So all of these attempts to focus specifically on children also don't succeed in actually supporting adults who are in many ways themselves confused about what's happening with data.
Dana Boyd of Microsoft Research. Saddle up. It's the
Robot Roundup.
Let's see what our cybernetic friends are up to now.
Robots
are sweating. The newly developed Petman simulates a soldier so that better clothes and equipment could be made. Petman walks, does push-ups, even sweats. Very lifelike, although the head is just a blinking red light. Hey, Petman, you sweaty, red-light-headed robot.
Robots
are climbing walls. Canadian researchers have built a robot with dry but sticky feet based on the feet of a gecko. They hope to use it in nuclear plant inspections or search and rescue.
Robots
are helping you with your shirt. Researchers at Nara Institute of Science and Technology in Japan have built a bot specially designed to put shirts on people. It works. Finally, a solution to the age-old problem of really wanting to wear a shirt but not wanting to put a shirt on yourself. We have videos of all these robots at MarketplaceTech.org. This is Marketplace Tech Report. I'm John Moe.
Marketplace Tech Report is supported by Best Buy for Business, with commercial-grade products and personal account managers to help your business be ready for anything. BestBuy.com/business.
Tomorrow on Word of Mouth, they said it couldn't be done. A rundown of how once impossible inventions like smartphones, lasers, and rockets overcame the doubting Thomases. And the tricky problem of retractions. How journals deal with saying oops after making honest mistakes and worse. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth owns up to new ideas. Tomorrow at noon and again at 9 p.m. on NHPR.
Here and now, next at 1 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our members, and from Pax World Mutual Funds, a leader in sustainable investing, integrating environmental, social, and governance factors into investment analysis and decision making. PaxWorld.com for tomorrow. And Mountain View Grand Resort and Spa, a landmark luxury destination since 1865 and proud member of Historic Hotels of America. MountainViewGrand.com. These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio, WEVO Concord 89.1, WEVS Nashua 89.1.